members. Not nearly enough time to give them, for us to gain the full breadth of what they can offer in this area, but I'm going to try to start as soon as we can on time. Is there a volunteer? Someone who could help us find some water? Sorry for such a mundane request, but these guys are speaking all the time. And for the three panelists, this particular panel is being recorded so that it can be posted. So they have asked us to use the mics, either from here at the podium or down there. Let me get started with the required formalities for each one of the sessions. If you are AIA, the forms are outside on the table. If you are AICP, you and almost everyone else in the conference attendees will get the email from CNU specifying the details for filling in the forms to get the credits that will be available for AICP. Good morning. My name is Jim Murley. I direct the Center for Urban and Environmental Solutions at Florida Atlantic University. I'm exiting as a national CNU board member, and I'm active in the Florida chapter of CNU, where we do a lot of regional work throughout our state. We are privileged to have three excellent speakers with us today. They're listed in the program. Andres Duane has been kind enough to agree to join this group. So with Dr. Steiner and Peter and Andres, I think you'll agree we have a great deal of experience and perspective on the issue of booming regions and how the region fits into the basic outline of the charter. And if you have reviewed the canons that have recently come out for our edification, the region is part of that framework also. So the region is a very important part of the work of the CNU, and this part of the sessions complements the larger one we had earlier on Envision Central Texas. So first, Dr. Steiner from the University of Texas is going to give us some background on Central Texas and a small summary on Envision Central Texas. Thank you.
Thank you. This is what I'm going to talk about today. First of all, talk about some big drivers of landscape change, of environmental change, talk about Central Texas specifically, and then a little bit about Envision Central Texas. Starting with sort of where we are in the world, I think many of you know this. We're, for the first time in human history, more than half the planet lives in urban regions. We're now in the first urban century. By mid-century, two-thirds of all the planet will live in cities or urban areas. There are now 300 million Americans living in urban areas. To put this in somewhat perspective, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were 2 billion people on the planet. There are now, it was 6.3 at the beginning of the 21st century. We're now about 6.7. It's expected to go up to about 9 or 11 million by the end of the mid-century and by the beginning of the next century. So what does that mean for places? This is some farmland north of Austin in 1951. This is what it looks like today, or it looks like 10 years ago. This is an area just to the southwest of us near Barton Creek in 1951. And this is what it looked like in 1995. I live in this slide, so I am part of what's going on in this region. And we can ask a very fundamental question. Did we really plan to go from where we were to where we are? The red splotch is Austin, Texas in 1955. This is the red is the urbanized area of Austin in 1973. In 1983, in 1991, in 2000. And one could, if we were a group of cardiologists rather than architects and urbanists looking at these slides, I think it would be some cause for alarm. The high point in Austin is a place called Mount Bunnell. This is what it looked like in the 1980s. This is what it looks like today. So what are some of the consequences of urbanization and population growth? There are different levels of consumption, larger ecological footprints, obviously suburban sprawl, the loss of prime farmland, biodiversity and cultural diversity, social inequalities, crime, the urban heat island, and, of course, our health. As we all know, Americans are getting fatter. And I think it's also worthwhile to step back just for a second and say, okay, urbanization, population growth are very, very big drivers of change. They're not the only drivers. We opened the other night with a talk from our mayor talking about global climate change. Certainly global and regional environmental processes are changing. We also are becoming a much more connected planet, technology, economics, and politics. So there are other drivers as well. So here we are in the first urban century. Without guidance, foresight, planning, design, we're going to lose our sense of place, our regional identity, our landscapes, and our cultural heritage, which brings us here to Central Texas. I love NASA. If you look at that map of Texas, you see this green heart of Texas right where we're sitting. We're on the interface between the Edwards Plateau to the west of us and to the Blackland Prairie to the east of us. The Balcones Canyonlands and the Edwards Aquifer fit in between. Austin is here right in that green heart. If we look at this map, that interface between the Edwards Plateau to the west and the Blackland Prairie to the east certainly has been a focus of settlement throughout the time there's been humans in this area. The Native Americans, the Indians, were very smart. They realized that there are great springs along this interface. It was a great place to hunt. They had two different habitats to hunt from. The Spanish came. They were pretty smart, too. They established missions in San Antonio and then San Marcos. Then the Germans came at New Braunfels. Throughout the Texas history, this interface has been very important. It's also very beautiful. Those of you who aren't from Texas, this is one of the really most beautiful places in North America. I used to, before I moved to Texas, think oil was the great wealth of Texas, and as this morning illustrated, I think really water is the key to a lot of what's going on in Texas. But a very beautiful region. Why are these two guys looking into a hole? They're both geologists, and they're looking into a sinkhole. One of the reasons why this area is so rich is the groundwater recharges very, very rapidly. It's a very clean source of water and a very sustainable source. Of course, the cultural heart of Austin is Barton Creek. This is also the home of two endangered species of salamanders. So there's nights when clothing is optional, or swimming trunks are optional. So naked Austinites swim with naked salamanders and coexist. And this has driven a lot of the planning in this area is the protection of this water source. This is just a map of the watershed and the aquifer zones around the region. Also to remember just how rich those soils are to the east. And they're rich for a reason. The rivers and springs come off of that plateau and deposit those soils towards the coastal plain. And then this just shows how thick, and you don't have to be a soil scientist to recognize how rich the soils are. Around Austin, the patterns of development are those that you're all familiar with, and why we're all here, because we find them repulsive. In addition to sort of traditional suburban sprawl, we also have a phenomena of very large lot subdivision in the rural areas as well that is really fragmenting the region. So here we are, the Capitol, the Barton Springs, the Lady Bird Johnson Wildfire Center. What we face here with the doubling of population, Austin has doubled in population every 20 years since 1898. We're on target to double again. We're about 1.2 million, 1.3 million, going up to about 2.5 million. And this is part of a larger phenomena, the mega-region phenomena. This is a map drawn by students at the University of Pennsylvania, taught by Armando Carbondale from the Lincoln Institute, who's here in the audience. They've identified these mega-regions, including the Texas Triangle, something we like here in Texas. This is a more refined version. There has been some discussion and debate with various demographers. One in particular didn't like the Texas Triangle, wanted to call it the I-35 corridor, which we in Texas balked. This Texas cities may not get along, but we're Texan. So we think the Texas Triangle is important, and essentially that's Dallas and Fort Worth up at the apex. Somebody pointed out, I think it was Armando, that it's really not a triangle when you have two apexes, but I don't know what the other geometric form is. And at the base, we have San Antonio and Houston. So, which brings us to Envision Central Texas. Started in 2001. Much of the work was done by our consultants, John Fregonese and Peter Calthorpe, who guided the process. Why was this important? We're becoming a victim of our own success. We've got another 1.25 million people. If anybody's driven on I-35, you know about the congestion. Air pollution is already near non-attainment. Urban sprawl is rampant, rising infrastructure costs, and a lack of regional collaboration and cooperation. So what is it? It's a five-county region. Part of the problem we faced here in Austin was Austin is this little blue dot in this big red sea. I remember during the last election actually thinking, what was the guy from Massachusetts? Kerry had a fighting chance in Texas. And I was invited by my friends over at Texas A&M to give a talk, and I left the Austin city limits and didn't see another Kerry sign for a couple days until I got back to Austin. And realized that once you leave the city limits, you're in a different world. And what Envision Central Texas, and one struggle we had in Austin was Austin would pass environmental laws, would pass planning laws, which would then be undone by the state. So what we tried to do with this effort was basically get the red people and the blue people to talk and come up with a common vision. We all know what the traditional approach is. Thanks to John and Peter, we developed a scenario approach. It involved literally thousands of people. We got everybody together, and of course, most of them from Austin, the first thing they said is, we don't want another 1.25 million people. And then we sort of forced them to look at where they would like to develop in the future. Lots of public workshops, digitized the map. I'm going to roll through this fairly quick. Then built a series of scenarios, and they were essentially used the same baseline of development types, the same number of population, a commuter rail line, bus routes, toll roads, which were already being suggested. And then we tried under C and D of the options to put in more bike and pedestrian, and they all had the same price tag. So the red stuff is the urbanized area, the green areas are the protected green areas, and then you can see the pink and other colors are other land uses. This is scenario A, basically business as usual. The major transportation elements, express bus line, rapid bus transit, toll roads, commuter rail. What would life be like in scenario A? More Walmarts, more this kind of stuff. And this is the consequences of that. Another almost 500,000 acres of land to be developed. A relatively large area of land being redeveloped. 68 minutes a day getting around in a car. A lot of the recharge area, 36,000 acres being developed. And not a very good job balance in the area. Scenario B, we didn't name these, you know, but I kind of have names for them. But scenario B is the ULI option. And what does our friends in ULI, well, they're smart developers, reasonable people, mean well. Essentially what they proposed was, let's just do a lot of infill along the major transportation elements. So this is express bus, light rail, the same things, and then what the consequences are, what would life be like. Still Walmarts, still highway corridors, but a lot less land needing to be developed, more land being redeveloped, less time in a car by 4 minutes, and so on. Scenario C. Oh, I think this is the architect's scenario. What do architects like? They like new towns. So with this one, we get lots of new towns around the region, and the new towns would be kind of neo-traditional, new urbanist kind of new towns, like Bastrop. And good number of acres reduced significantly. Less time in an automobile, more land redeveloped, and so on. Scenario D is kind of the planner's dream. What do planners like? Oh, they love infill. So in scenario D, we've got loads and loads of infill, more rail, and so on. Pretty much what's happening in Austin, more high-rises. Of course, all the planners like a lot of coffee. This they share with the architects. So probably scenario C and D, we have a lot more cappuccino per capita than, and of course, rail. We're down to only 85,000 acres needing to be developed, more redeveloped land, down to 57 minutes in the car, less land to be redeveloped or over the aquifer and so on. We then employed a number of indicators to show the consequences of each of these. I don't have a whole lot of time, but just to give you a flavor, you can see where we are in 2000, where scenario A is, and where scenario B and D, C and D are. And for transportation, the environment, how much new impervious surface, very important for the aquifer, for our little friends, the salamanders down in Barton Creek, and the recharge area, the amount of ranch and agricultural land, the housing mix. Even the planners weren't going to put all these Texans in apartment buildings. There's still single-family houses. Just a mix would be different. The cost for the infrastructure. And at the same time, Peter Calthorpe's office did a number of workshops and created some very useful diagrams to show how these scenarios would play out through design with specific projects. They also developed very helpful, and these are all on our website, a very helpful plan and axonomic diagram showing how this could be done. These are for fourplex and so on. At the university, meanwhile, we did parallel sites. We looked through studio projects at the same sites that Calthorpe Associates did. These are these kind of wonderful GIS maps. One of the architecture students, I love this one, basically did new urbanism for the critters and basically designed the Featherlight site from an animal perspective. Really cool stuff, you know, where the turtles would, their connectivity and so on. And so this was the same site that Peter used from an animal's perspective. We continued through the visioning process, did a survey, got lots of response, essentially asking people what they liked on the web. You could either, you had the option of either voting straight ticket or mixing and matching. This is the responses by county. We looked at the best scenario was by far and away D. This is what people want in this area. 13,000, almost 13,000 responses we thought was pretty good for this kind of thing. These are the key elements of the vision. I'm going to go to the preferred scenario, which is a combination of C and D. And then we applied the same indicators to the preferred, and you can see those. At first, I should say I've been involved in this process since it began and served two terms as chair of Envision Central Texas. Our executive committee is an interesting cross-section of diverse groups and interests. I was the only one who voted for a map when we did the scenario first. 2 years later, the board decided we needed a map, so John Fregonese and Peter Calthorpe produced a map for us. These are the key elements, and we're now in implementation. We have implementation committees. We have newsletter. One morning we woke up and the mayor said the new bond issue would be an Envision Central Texas bond issue. He wisely didn't consult with Envision Central Texas before that. As a former board member, he realized, you know, that wouldn't be successful. So he put half of the bond committee was made up of Envision Central Texas board members. All seven parts passed overwhelmingly. They increase funding for transportation, water quality, parks, a creative economy, affordable housing, libraries, and health and safety. We also created a stewardship award that recognizes new development, redevelopment, pioneer development, public policy and planning, public awareness, and the Neo Kusurik, the man who really got Envision Central Texas started and unfortunately died right as the vision was being published. We've also developed a partnership with the Trust for Public Land to develop a green print. We finished the green print for Travis County. We've got the funding for the other four counties, and so we've been mapping the green print to direct where open space funding will be. Also have developed a quality growth toolbox, which is on the web, which has examples of best practices for growth. So the basic message, I guess, I have is think globally, act locally, and plan regionally. We're in the business of a competitive business where regions that prosper will be dedicated to the creation of knowledge capital, the enhancement of social capital, and the preservation of natural capital. So with that, thank you very much. I think I'm more or less on time.
We've timed this so there will be time for questions at the end, because we know that any participants at the Congress want to partake of that. So, Peter, do you want to follow up?
No.
Oh, no. So, I think Andres is going to follow up.
You're going to plug in? Are you ready to go?
Plug in. That's pretty good. I need to get a good headphone. Well, the plug is PowerPoints, each reading is a different stage in process.
Thank you very much. Big topic, confusing topic. I think quite thoroughly and brilliantly unconfused by Peter Calthorpe and John Fregonese. I read a lot of history. I find it clarifying to know where we've been. One also tends to believe that you can avoid making mistakes if you observe the mistakes that others have made. And so I've always found it's a side pursuit that I have, the theory of planning. And I have to say, one of the things I've concluded is that regional planning is a very new pursuit. If you discount the military, the roads of the Roman Empire, the bastide towns of the French, the walls that protected the towns of Europe. Regional planning, and if you, of course, the Jeffersonian grid, regional planning probably arises, as so many things do, with Ebenezer Howard, who actually said the city must stop, new cities must be implanted, and it should be connected by rail, and there should be a hinterland of farming. It was the first time, one of the exciting things about that concept was it was so utterly new. That it really was very much a regional design. Ebenezer Howard's, of course, that's about 1898, influence was such that it became the pursuit, and some of the finest minds in the world dedicated themselves to regional planning issues. And there was a proliferation right through the 20s and 30s, which I pursued when we were preparing civic art, the new civic art. The new civic art is a collection of the literature. We leaf through virtually every book we could get our hands on, and we extracted the diagrams and wrote captions explaining what they represented. One of the things that we had to do as we got to know the entire literature is to see the extent of the propositions, but it also became clear that all those many propositions were graphically different, and they had different scales. But then in the end, there were only two ideas. They folded back the two ideas. And we could even trace the beginning of each idea. And these are diagrams from the lexicon of the New Urbanism. And I have extracted, if you have the lexicon, you will see there are actually three bars. The urban boundary model, the rural boundary model, and the third one, which I excluded here because I thought Peter was present, essentially is the Calthorpe model, which is the TOD, the third invention. And I thought he would let himself present it. But if you want to, I'll do it too. I just left the diagram out. But the lexicon has three diagrams. The first one is the urban boundary model. And the urban boundary model is like a dam. You basically stop the city, stop it sprawling, and then you refound another city, which is quasi-complete for most things, although you do go back to the center city, let us say, for first-rate entertainment, first-rate shopping, perhaps higher education, hospitals, and so forth. But the satellite towns called garden cities are quasi-independent, and they're justified by the stopping distances of efficient rail. You know, and those old trains were not, you know, they couldn't stop very often, and they're also justified by hinterland of farming. And Ebenezer Howard, as I said, was the foundation. And this is, one would say, the Portland model. Okay, and Portland is drawn here. Here is the Ebenezer Howard diagram, stopping the city, the rail lines going out, the garden cities at the stopping distances of trains. And here is a diagram based on Portland. And basically what you see is that there's pressure. There is pressure. The arrows go inward to stop the growth. Now, where do you establish that urban boundary? That urban boundary is statistically determined. Growth only needs this much land, and so you draw the boundary, as they did in Portland, let's say to accommodate 20 years' growth. And when the time comes, you decide in a rational way whether to expand it or not. Okay, so that's called, that is the urban boundary model. The rural boundary model is equally old. It's only about 10 years older. And it was conceived by a New Englander, very famous, as he was our Ebenezer Howard, called Benton McKay. Benton McKay has a book. He, for example, is best known for establishing the Appalachian Trail. He did it, the Appalachian Trail. He is less well known for preparing the regional plan for the Boston region. Now, if you go to Boston, you will notice, and you drive around that area of New England, you know, even to the adjacent states, you will notice that although it's bad, there's sprawl and all that, it is much less bad than other places. And in fact, if you have a good guide, and John Massengale once was my guide, you can spend the entire day crisscrossing the region and not see any bad stuff, which means there's substantial agglomerations of preserved and well-designed land. In that model, the rural boundary, instead of drawing the line from the city, draws the line from nature. It's exactly the converse. It basically says these are areas that should not be developed. And Benton McKay called it the levees and streams. In other words, you create levees, you create walls around that which should be preserved. And by the way, those things that should be preserved would be the villages of New England, you know, beautiful landscape, riverine corridors, mountainsides, and so forth. So you draw around that. You protect that with levees, and then the urbanism streams past. Okay, and you never have to stop it. It just, wherever it happens, it streams past. Interesting thing about the rural boundary is that it is now getting to be 80, 90 years old. I believe he did it in 1917. And you have to test regional planning to the greatest extent, almost beyond any other human endeavor. I can't think of any other human endeavor other than imposing a world religion that might take a century or a couple of centuries. Other than imposing that, regional planning is the longest time frame of any human endeavor. So you really have to test to see how we're doing. How are we doing essentially 80 and 100 years later? And as far as I can tell, Portland is in a maybe state because the urban boundary keeps growing. But New England, the New England area around Boston, is a signal success. It is different. It is perceptible that there's a difference. That system is diagrammed like this, in which you draw wedges, right? You draw wedges like this. The diagram is a, in fact, it's called the, it later it came to be called the corridors and wedges model. That's a synonym for it. And it was used around Washington, D.C. The Parks and Planning Capital Committee, you know, the committee that is in charge of the Washington-Baltimore corridor, at some point in the 40s and 50s drew wedges, which are like that, around certain areas, and the growth happens around corridors. So you get corridors. Now, the corridors are utterly miserable. Strip development. And so you get that, the perception is that it's all ruined, isn't it? That it's all ruined. In Boston, you can also, just as Massengale is going to take you through a whole day of wonderful stuff, you can spend the entire day on complete garbage. Because if you stay on the corridor, you get standard issue sprawl. But behind that, half a mile away, is intact countryside. So these are the two models. The interesting thing about this one, which might make it more long-lived, and one of the reasons that I like it better, is that while the urban boundary in a place like Portland, and I've been to see it, is actually on the ground non-existent. It basically is a farmer on this side that is very wealthy and a farmer on that side that is not. So the waterfall, you know, the different levels of value, you know, there's so many tens and hundreds of millions of dollars involved that you can pay consultants and lawyers for a very long time to move that boundary. You know, the differential is too great between being inside and outside. It's indefensible in the sense that when you go see the line, it's not that there's no difference between this farm and that farm. The urban boundary, the rural boundary, on the other hand, which is based on a perceptible line, like, excuse me, this is a river, or this is the foot of a mountain, or this is a woodland of historical significance, right, is actually defensible. So when it goes to a court of law, you can actually defend it. Okay, so these are the two models. We have implemented in the smart code as a protocol the second model. And the reason I tend to do this is that there's something that has happened in Florida. Everywhere I work, which is the southeast, everybody has five-acre zoning. You know, no one really, you see a farm, beautiful farm in Ocala, all that has the cancer of zoning. At any time, somebody can sprout a subdivision. So you have to deal with that reality. People that say, draw an urban boundary, I say, I don't, you know, that might be a Northwestern dream of drawing an urban boundary. But in the Southwest, and it has to do with Jimmy Carter and certain things he did for helping farmers get loans back in the 70s, we have an awful lot of two and five acre zoning, which we have to deal with because they have rights. People have rights to develop, so we have to deal with that. Anyway, so we developed a system that goes like this. Step one is you establish the land which is already will never be developed, either because environmental law or because it's been purchased by a land trust or for any reason. You know, there are many, many GIS, of the many GIS elements, you can group them. GIS is a great confusion. They have 57 or something categories. But if you group them, they actually become intelligible. And the groupings are this. There is land that will never be developed. Okay, stop worrying about it. It'll never happen. Draw a line around that. That's called the rural preserve. Okay? Then there's land that should never be developed. Should never. Everybody knows it shouldn't be developed, but it's not defended yet. Okay, and that's where the battle is. So it calls attention immediately to those categories, you know, that could be listed in GIS and so forth, and everybody knows you shouldn't be developing around that lake, you shouldn't be, but the law hasn't been passed yet. And so it calls attention to that. And then there's land, other criteria, that you know you'll never stop it, never in your dreams, but you can actually have it, you can cause it to happen later, simply by not feeding it roads, not feeding it infrastructure, not helping it out. You can't tell them you can't develop, because the lawsuit is immediate. Right? But you can just not feed them, not give them the blood of development. And then there are areas that you want to encourage, which are infill and the greenfield areas that definitely should happen. So you go through a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5-step protocol using GIS, practically automatic, relatively inexpensive. This we did, and by the way, I should know one thing. I used to think I did regional planning until I saw Peter's and Vision Plans, you know, in California, Texas, Louisiana, and so forth. And that's regional planning. What we do is we design sectors, you know, like the north of a county and so forth. So one can be, right from the beginning, much more precise than Peter can be. Peter can end up being precise, but because of the scale of what we call regional planning, or at least our firm does, it's totally different. This, for example, is northern Hillsborough County, where Tampa is, and we went through the protocol. In orange is the land that will never be developed, never, principally for environmental and parks reason. And we agglomerated those 8 GIS categories, and they went orange. Don't worry about those. The other, the light orange, the crosshatch, are lands that should not be developed but are currently vulnerable. And they're mostly connectivity corridors, and both to connect the open areas, the other open areas, and riparian corridors and so forth. Okay, so the wetlands, you know, and the purchases are in orange. This, the other, the light orange, and that is what we want to activate through transfer of development rights. Okay, on the other side, we begin and we say, on these areas, which are the dark orange, which are Peter's TODs, okay, these are areas that have transportation, you know, that will be hit by rail or simply have such good road frontage. They're usually shopping malls. We will throw whatever they can get. We just give them zoning. You have them all? Fine. Here, take 2 million square feet of office and 3,000 apartments. Take it. And actually, by giving it to developers who wouldn't otherwise ask for it, you basically starve the other development because they take it, they have it at a lower basis. You know, they have land for nothing. So we throw density at these malls. And then these other areas here, these other areas, we starve the other way. We don't give them enough density. So they have to buy TDRs. Okay? And that's what the plan looks like. And together, it looks like that. In the end, Actually, these are the transfer of development rights. These are the TDR sending areas, the TDR receiving areas, right? And in the end, you end up with a county, hopefully, that looks something like this. And that county is approximately, probably 30% decent. 30% decent open space, 30% decent urbanism, and then 60% sheer garbage. And when everybody says, well, is that good enough? Liz always reminds me, we were expelled from the Garden of Eden, you know. You know, and considering that there are entire counties in Florida that have neither decent open space, you know, this is a signal achievement. It is relatively simple. At some level, the people can understand it. And that is a proposition. It was used in Mississippi very quickly. We went through the protocols through the 11 cities in Mississippi, and it looked like that. Now, this is much more crude than the Tampa one. This was actually done with intersection spacing and so forth, but those were the steps that were involved. And then the smart code was actually written to implement that, you know, to actually say, in those areas where we want growth, this is the code that will assure it. And that's the method. But I just want to say that the fourth one, I'm going to explain, since Peter gave me permission to explain his method. What Peter did, and very early on when I showed him there are two ways, like this, and I don't know whether you remember this, Peter. I said, look, Peter, there's two ways. I discovered this. And he said, yes, and we must have both available. That's the first thing you said. I must have both available. But his overlay is actually two total innovations. First of all, it's a retrofit. Okay, the TOD method, the Envision Central Texas, is heavily about retrofit. There's a lot of urbanism out there. The other planners, the historic planners, were not about retrofit. The green fields were open. The cities were dense. Okay, and the second thing that Peter had to introduce, and I'm not sure how much he, in the end, he feels strongly about this. He's probably exhausted. He made it profoundly democratic, you know. And that which was the method that you just presented was how do you get everybody to participate in this? All the prior plans were top-down plans, absolute top-down plans, and they work best, by the way, when Hitler and Stalin were in place. You know, whatever was implemented of the European plans were Louis XIV, Napoleon III, Hitler, and Stalin. Absolutely top down. Haussmann was a smaller scale guy. But so you have a situation in which we actually do not have access to that kind of planning, the first two. It has to be, it's the horse is out of the barn, we have to retrofit, and we have to ask everybody. And that's why we have Peter speaking next.
I just want to note, Andres did it within his time frame.
Yeah. Listen, actually, I'm not going to give a speech. I'd like to just start the discussion. That's okay.
Absolutely. Do you want to comment at all on...
Yeah, I will, of course.
All right, then we're going to open it up to, I'm sure, some questions.
I want to make a comment, then I think this panel needs a discussion, then we could open it up. That was very good. I mean, having those two presentations back to back was absolutely perfect. It just shows the state of the art in regional planning, which is, I think, incredibly sophisticated at this point, and something that I've always encouraged the CNU to be a little more focused on. We tend to go from thing to thing and not stay, you know, it is one of our primary principles, and we need to get at it. Let me go through what I think is the three steps that we have to get to, and each one involves a lot of questions. First is this consensus building, and that has to do partly with this democratic process, but also it has to do with understanding each region in its specifics. And the diagrams of Howard and that you showed, and also the methodology, Andreas, that you were talking about, works to certain degrees in some places, but not in all. So if you go to Phoenix or Las Vegas or Albuquerque, and you did your mapping, you would find that there are absolutely no constraints based on land. There's constraints based on water supply and things like that, but that's infrastructure. That's man-made issues. So once again, we get into our East Coast, West Coast differentiation. In the West Coast, there are, in many areas, very few natural constraints. There are very few places that you can put a stake in the ground and say, this is a coherent rural boundary that you can defend. It just doesn't exist. And so the methodology works in some circumstances, not in others. The first step in regional planning is this local engagement, which begins to reveal these issues. And it also, you know, so for example here, the aquifer and the recharge zone, lots of things like that. Actually, this area is quite rich in its natural constraints. And of course, actually, in many ways, presents situations in which you have to override the natural boundary. So the counterpoint also to the Phoenix example of no boundaries are boundaries that conflict with where development should be. So wherever there's a crossing of development infrastructure and capacity, for example, here, you have probably the richest area in terms of existing underutilized railroad right-of-ways. The first new light rail line, the Northwest Line, is using an old track that used to be freight, actually used to be all-purpose rail. And there are two or three other prime opportunities. So transit can run in this area. It runs across the aquifer. It runs across what would be the rural boundary. So immediately you get into the conflict between a straight-ahead simplistic mapping of where the boundaries are from a rural and environmental standpoint and what you need to do to satisfy the needs of the growing region. So I think those are all important tools, but they have to be taken and placed in the local context, and that's step one. The local context needs to map out the environmental constraints. It needs to look at the human resources and opportunities, and it also needs to come to grips with the market forces, which are always different in different regions. And so the market forces give birth to different overall densities. You saw in your presentation the remarkable difference in our scenarios in terms of the overall footprint that the region would need to satisfy the same population. That, you know, sooner or later turns into market forces in, you know, what proportion of multifamily to single family, townhouse, small lot to large lot, all that stuff has to play out. So it is a complex endeavor. And in the end, we do what I said, which is you combine various models, a boundary model and a rural model and a TOD model. The TOD model, the TOD model introduces one other element, and it's not just transit-oriented development. It introduces the issue of, well, what type of development? You've got a red zone for, and you showed it with your circles, your hierarchy, but what kind of development is also a key component? And so we will often in our regional planning process give people maps, give them chips and say this is the next million people in current densities, and that's a simple density location issue. And then in the next workshop, we'll actually give people whole packages of chips, and we'll say this is a mixed-use high-density chip, this is a low-use single residential chip, actual community types, and let them choose the different building types, because in the end it's a huge mix. So there's this whole consensus phase which sorts out all the very complex and peculiar aspects of each region, and that's a very necessary step. It leads you to the what. What do you want to achieve with your regional plan? In almost all cases, I could show you, we've now done 8 major regional plans around this country. The results on some level are always the same, and they are a blend of all the typologies that you identified. They end up to be polycentric networks, not simple Ebenezer Howard satellite cities, not simple linear corridors of developments, but complicated mixes of those two. Embedded in them certain hierarchies of land use. So if the Ebenezer Howard model is simplistic, that these satellite cities are freestanding, and that was one of his key components, was that the jobs-housing balance. And this will get to something key for the new urbanist. Jobs are never distributed ideally across the region. Job centers and the way they cluster are a complex matter which I don't think we really have a handle on. And just mandating that we're going to have a nice jobs housing balance in each satellite city or each TOD, quite frankly, is never going to happen. In the same way that we failed in new urbanism to actually say this is the way retail is going to distribute itself. No, retail comes in increments that are kind of a given at this point to us, and we as new urbanists have to work with that as one of our design challenges. So the unequal distribution of jobs within the urbanized area is one of the key components to the performance of the region. It affects the VMT. It affects carbon. It affects all those. It affects congestion and transit utilization. So it's not freestanding satellites, and it's not just corridors. It's a mix of all these. You mentioned a little bit about Portland, and what's fascinating about Portland is I actually think the urban growth boundary, which doesn't have an arbitrary rural standard, raises the right questions, which is, given that you can't depend on a rural edge, a defensible rural edge, how do you establish a boundary? Well, the first question that comes is, well, how much land do you need? And so when the state legislation in Oregon says you have to maintain a 20-year inventory of land for 20 years' worth of growth, well, embedded in that are two questions. Well, what is the growth over the next 20 years? What's the population increase going to be? And what density is it going to come at? And just by asking those two questions and having to work through the political process of answering them before they can readjust the boundary is a profoundly important step in a region taking a hold of its own future. Because if you don't answer those two questions, how many people are coming? How many people do we need to prepare for? And at what density do we see the communities evolving? If you don't answer those two, you really can't get at much of a coherent future for the region. So the state legislation actually, I think, creates a really healthy starting point for urbanism. Once you've done that, and so I think, and this is our practice, the best approach to how you take all these issues and conflate them into something the public can digest is through scenarios. And this is what businesses have been doing for decades and actually what the military does. Everybody does, but planners in general. Planners tend to try and do the plan. They go out and do the general plan for their town, and they're just going to do a plan. No, they should do scenarios. They should do three or four versions of it so that they're well-informed at what the trade-offs are, because it's all these complex overlapping gradations. And until you see it is the only way to cope with it as a series of scenario analysis. The scenarios always lead to some clarity about where you want to go. And I really like your definition, the ULI, the architects, and this. I'm going to start using that. The reason we don't name our scenarios is that we try not to bias. We're constantly being attacked as being biased towards new urbanism. I don't know why people would think that, but they seem to think we're biased. So we try not to name them, because naming, of course, is always a loaded framing of an issue. But certainly naming them ULI, architect, and planner doesn't load them in any direction, I don't think. So you have a scenario process. You come to some consensus. And what's remarkable is in every circumstance, a consensus emerges, pretty dramatic consensus. Here, you went through very quickly the bar charts, but the consensus comes out almost always for good new urbanism, for density, transit, walkability, and land preservation. It always ends up there, I hate to say. And, a lot of people are critical to say, well, where this is going to end, so why do it? Because the actual endpoint has those qualities, but it also has a tremendous amount of local intelligence and all the nuance and complexity of the place is built into that scenario. So it's not just that it's denser and more transit-oriented and more walkable. It's also that it skips lightly through the terrain in an intelligent way and places intensities and follows resources, both man-made and natural. So now we've got that. And we've got a vision for what to do. The third step, and that's the what. So one is the scenarios. The second is defining the preferred, the what. And it's a very complex mapping, and it needs a lot of explanation. The third is how. And this is where we're stuck across the country. We have these great regional plans. They have no political muscle. They have no bite. And we need state legislation throughout the country, and I'll just be very quick on this. We need state legislation. There are different models. I prefer the Washington state model. Do I have time to actually explain these?
I think so. Yep.
Okay. The Washington state model, unlike the Portland model says we're going to have a regional entity, a regional planning entity that will take people through the process of deciding how many people, what density, and then where that increment of growth should be based on lots of factors. And it's very clean and very simple. And then when they come to a decision, that's the new urban growth boundary. But now there's more to it than just the urban growth boundary. Inside the boundary is this whole hierarchy of urbanism. And that's what I think the new urbanists have succeeded in injecting into their process. Because prior to 1990, they had this urban growth boundary since the 70s, and it was, as Andreas correctly stated, it was sprawl inside the boundary. So what difference did it make? I mean, it's just like sprawl along those corridors in Maryland. And now their regional planning entity not only sets boundaries, but also sets design standards for the development within, which the local jurisdictions then have to pick up on. That's very nice. It's very hard politically to get a piece of legislation like that passed. The Washington State model is more subtle. It basically says each region has to create a regional plan. And there are regional entities, MPOs in every region, doing this anyway. They're just largely powerless. They have to create a plan that meets certain environmental and traffic and air quality and water standards and fair share housing, something we were talking more about in the Hope 6 panel. A whole list of criteria of how the region should perform. So the regional entity creates this kind of a menu of performance criteria, arrives at a very schematic plan, one without an urban growth boundary, and then passes that off to the local jurisdiction and says, okay, this is how many people, how much affordable housing, this is the infrastructure context that you're going to work within. You create a plan, and this is how many acres of development that you are allocated. You create a plan for your community. You set that boundary. So the local jurisdiction creates the urban growth boundary. So it's kind of decentralized, centralized. It's a very interesting mix, and it's working very, very well. But all of these things take state-enabling legislation in order to make them happen, and it's something that every state needs. And, you know, a Republican legislature is categorically against all of the above, regardless of whether it makes sense or not, just because philosophically they call it more government, and we don't want more government. So that's a whole other discussion. But clearly this is advocacy that we as new urbanists need to go to. We need to operate at the state level and advocate this. There is a new tool, which is fascinating. If you look right now, if you want to get your federal highway dollars, you have to comply with CEQA air quality standards for your region. And so, for example, in L.A., the regional plan really goes to trying to satisfy federal air quality standards in order to get federal dollars for transportation. And that leads them into a whole land use transportation nexus. It seems to me that now, and the state of California has done this, now that carbon emissions and global warming has become an environmental impact like other dimensions of air quality, certainly the land use drives the CO2 emissions in a very, very profound way, perhaps even more than other air quality issues. Either at a state level, and the state of California is now looking finally at enabling legislation for regional planning and regional mandates because of the carbon emission goals that have come into being. The same could happen at the federal level. As EPA says, if we ever get to the point where we have an administration that joins Kyoto and sets some standards other than cap and trade for where we end up with carbon, that is going to trickle down to the states with mandates. Basically, you as a state have to perform this way in order to meet our carbon emission goals over the next 10, 15, 20 years. That will then translate into a force that will revitalize what is very dormant in most states, the need to create state-enabling legislation for regional planning with real teeth. So I see this as a golden moment, quite frankly, because we can use the carbon emission issue to drive something we dearly need, which is the enabling legislation to make this kind of regional planning, whatever form it takes, happen in a ubiquitous manner. Thank you.
I want to comment, and then we'll open it up.
First of all,
I'm sure Peter doesn't know this. I drafted the Washington State law.
My God!
And was
this planned or what?
So no. Well, it's eerie because the politics were very interesting because it was a Republican governor, and we got beat up. We brought it back three different times, and we got beat up the first two times we brought it. But the criticism was that it was going to be an Oregon law.
Yeah.
And literally, I copied a law from Wisconsin. I borrowed a planning statute from Wisconsin, which basically took all the rural counties out of the equation and focused on the fast growth counties. So that's kind of interesting. But it was a great experience. I want to comment a little bit on Andrus's presentation because. And excuse me for being a little bit personal here, but I've been having a debate with you in my head for the last couple of years, and I didn't know how the debate would end until today. And you weren't a part of the—I mean, you were a part of the—you drove the debate, but weren't a party in it and didn't know that this was going on. And it began with. An article that you and Emily Talon wrote, and I was the blind reviewer, and you don't know that because you aren't supposed to divulge who the reviewer is. And obviously the paper got published, but I got to the part, it was about transsex, and there was no mention in the original paper of Patrick Geddes or Ian McCart. And, you know, here I've been trained to do transsex, to do by Ian himself. And I think underrealized that the whole layer cake notion is really the theoretical foundation for GIS. I mean, that's where, how GIS is organized. So, you know, as a good reviewer, I said, well, this is a great paper, but they got to cite Geddes and McCart, which you did.
Well, so, you mean I do it in my lectures?
Yeah, you do now? Yeah.
Yeah, I've always done.
Well, in the paper it wasn't there.
No.
So that started this debate, and then... about a year or two ago, the wonderful piece that Elizabeth Platter-Zeidberg and Charles Bowles did in Places also has actually a more beautiful rendering of McCart's transect than he would have done. But nonetheless, there was a statement in there about urbanism versus environmentalism, and that perturbed me. And so I was flying to Venice at the time, and I was reading this article and getting more and more perturbed. And then there's an article or a chapter you did in a book.
I remember that, on coding.
And there's a section where you take on Anse Byrne and Ian McCart and John Lyle. And basically argue, they don't really understand urban form. And, you know, I'm thinking, no, that's not true. I mean, McCart spent 10 years doing courtyard houses, much like Stephanos Palaiologos. And I still think the Woodlands has a lot of lessons. Here's where I think that there's a fourth type of regionalism, and it actually has much more common lineage than I realized. And if we take the precursor of Benton McKay, it was Charles Eliot and Olmsted's Emerald Necklace.
Right.
You take the Emerald Necklace, you go to McKay. McKay's good friend is McCart's mentor, Lewis Mumford.
Right.
And what I think...
A friend of Geddes.
And a good friend of Geddes. And what I think they... I think the urban form that McCart, Spurn, Lyle were proposing was a new urban form. And it would be a more... And I don't have a name for it, but a network or a web-based form rather than the boundary form. It has very... A lot of... similarities to, and the interesting thing is that the maps you showed, I think, were much more, those maps were much more a web system or a network system than necessarily a boundary system,
right.
Either rural or urban.
Right.
So without you
commenting on the debate. I've closed it in my own mind. So thank you.
Well, let's, gentlemen, would I like to take some questions? Or Andres, did you want to comment? I think Andres. Okay, let's take some questions. We've got a little time. Yes, sir. Could you stand up and identify yourself, and that way you can be heard? We don't have a travel mic, I don't think.
Actually, the model, he justified it by...
Andres, could you pull the mic?
Yeah. He justified that size in a kind of not too difficult mathematical calculation having to do with dairy being able to come in. Basically, it was an agricultural model. This number of people in the kind of British density generate this much hinterland that they also had to purchase. Part of the Garden City purchased its own agricultural hinterland, and therefore it makes sense. What happened to that, and I read this, I forget where I read this almost immediately, it may have been in Fishland's book or some other sort of deep historian. They said a refrigeration almost immediately made that irrelevant. And then it became almost immediately the laughing stock. Oh, yeah, right, milk is going to size our cities. And what I learned from that was you can't hinge any plan on any one variable, okay, whether it be milk or precipitation or water, or VMT, because you never know what's going to happen. Like, I remember in Florida, some counties, you know, raising the bar as to water, you know, we're going to run out of water, et cetera. And then there were 2 years when there was a lot of water, and somehow the whole edifice of argument collapsed. And so my argument is always, you can't use a single criteria for anything ever. And I think that Peter's very complex, or at least your presentation, which was, had all the complexity, is more like it. Because although some of them may change, like there may be sort of an, you know, what if an engine comes out that actually works off hydrogen? Okay, then the whole clean air thing, the argument for urbanism based on clean air, automobile emissions, totally collapses. The day it happens, it collapses.
No. All hydrogen vehicles do is shift the point at which you burn the carbon.
Yeah, but politically,
it doesn't really. If you once again, that's why you have to look at things at a regional scale.
No, but let's say something does happen that undermines it, like happened to Howard.
Yeah, if we had fusion, that would work.
Well, but it always has to be. It always has to be the complex argument. You know, the complex criteria.
All right, next question, right here.
You know, I too was disappointed at the lack of specificity in the result. I have to be honest about that. And typically we do have a more specific response. Luckily here, you had Cap Metro pick up the ball and basically do finish the sentence, as it were. So X started by setting out these larger criteria. And it was very important that the public here digest the issues of density and transit-oriented development and where development should happen overall in the region, and not altogether get in the weeds of which transit alignments. Now, the weeds got fleshed out by, which I didn't show you, but I showed yesterday, so I didn't want to do it again, the Cap Metro plan, which looks very carefully at all the alignments possible. and raises a tremendous number of possibilities. One of which I would like to once again plug that there is a huge opportunity/crisis in this region, and that's the Mocan Corridor. That's the 130. They're building a new toll road over on the east side, for those of you not from Austin. And that's moving ahead. And it's all greenfield. So we all know what will happen out there. There is no power-empowered regional planning that's going to stop county by county, city by city from doing maybe some good things, a lot of really bad things. So the Mocan, running parallel to it, is an underutilized railroad right-of-way, just like the one they're putting their new light rail onto the Northwest Line. And under the Cap Metro Vision Plan, which really is meant to augment the ECT plan, that is seen as a series of TODs and a very coherent development pattern that actually is outside of the aquifer recharge zone. I mean, it's ideal for the future growth on lots of levels. Nobody's taking that on, and it's partly it goes back to my fundamental issue is until you have state enabling legislation that creates some higher authority to the ad hoc coalition of counties and cities, which never quite get it together in terms of conceiving these things, you will default to garbage. And then the same issue, without a clear vision of the land use implications, getting people on board with more transit at this point is probably problematic. So it's circular, but that is one particular focus of the issue. And I absolutely agree with you. The Act didn't go far enough, but luckily additional steps have already been taken.
Andrews?
I was going to say, in all these discussions, I always find there's a huge sort of cadaver in the room that people pretend isn't there. And that's the Florida Comprehensive Planning Act of 1985. It began in operation in 1990. And everything that everybody ever talks about coordinated planning from, at the state level, everything is in place in the Florida Comprehensive Planning Act. Again, we've been at it for a while. Jim Murley was the Secretary of Community Affairs for several years, which was actually the key office that implements that. And I think we need to have a discussion about what it did and what it didn't do. Because obviously it did some things, but obviously it did many, many things it did not do. And we need to analyze the failure of Florida, which was, and by the way, along with that, we need to analyze the failure of the urban boundary in Miami, the transit in Miami, all these things that Miami does well, including having county government. Because one of the things that I wouldn't like this organization to do is go headlong believing that certain things are going to work when, in fact, already in one place they haven't, or perhaps they need adjustment. And one more thing that I just want to emphasize at this point, and this is a separate issue. Once you pass state legislation, at some point, those of us who are planners know, and architects, that where the rubber hits the road is the code. The code can make you do things. You have an enormous number of administrators that are administering bad codes because they don't have good codes. And any state that has any kind of regional planning that doesn't also, by legislation, say, and every municipality must have a code of this type, not necessarily form-based code, not necessarily smart code, but a code that permits compact, connected, complex development. Okay, because right now what happens, and everybody down at the where the rubber hits the road will tell you, is all the comprehensive plans in Florida are fabulous. They all say the right thing. It's all about walking and compactness and this and that, but the codes don't follow up
the zoning,
at all.
The zoning
doesn't follow up at all. And furthermore, if you want to do something about it, like Dade County is, the bill is for Dade County is $3 million to write a code. City of Miami is 1.7. Dade County is 3, which is fine, but why can't we just get a prefabricated code or a series of codes? And I think the new urbanists, who are fantastic at codes, should actually not just give model legislation at the state level, but should actually offer a whole family of codes that will enable these things to happen. TOD codes, TND codes, cluster codes. The experts are in this organization, and all we need is the enabling legislation to say every municipality must have one at least as an option.
I know there is an initiative, and there was a panel on comprehensive plans leading to coding that I'm sure members have been following. Let me get right there. Yes, sir. Who wants to start on that?
Well, I think that's implied in Peter's answer that both are necessary. And I believe if you look at his plans, they're never quite on greenfield site. They tend to be on sites where already there are such things as shopping malls, you know, if you look at the regional plans. But implied in the combination of both is that some things stop and some things are reinforced to become new centers. There's another thing that Peter has added to this, and he's been trying to get the CNU to get to work on this, and it's the corridors. Remember that we say that that planning consists of neighborhoods, districts, and corridors, and we basically agreed that districts are what they must be. Neighborhoods have been our emphasis, and we have not really gotten a grip on corridors. And perhaps I think what may be out of date is the idea of the centralized new town. And perhaps the model is the lineal city, you know, the lineal city that has its own intelligence. And, of course, it has a history, actually. The lineal city has many things going for it. I think that in some ways Australia, the expansion of Perth, has aspects of lineal city to it. But, again, you know, my plea is always keep all options within the new urbanism. There's a tendency to remove options, saying, well, we're going to do it this way or that way, only urban boundary, only rural boundary, only this, only that. And I think we need everything. I don't think we should be in the process of exterminating any tool.
It's an interesting question, but I don't. I wouldn't support such a thing. Regions grow in very complex organic manners, and setting some arbitrary limit and saying, well, this is the right size, and after that, you got to breed a new city. In and of itself, is kind of artificial. It may be that the ratio between greenfield development and infill redevelopment, which in Portland now is around 40% infill redevelopment, which is interestingly enough exceeded by Los Angeles, which actually has 45% infill redevelopment, quite naturally because of its real urban boundaries, natural boundaries, the mountains and the ocean. And so there's what happens over time is perhaps there will be a shift towards more and more infill redevelopment as the culture matures and higher densities and urbanism is embraced. It's hard to say. It's hard for me to imagine that there's some arbitrary way of establishing the point at which you say that's the right size and that's enough. And it's also hard for me to imagine satellite from the ground up towns actually working. I mean, we've seen this happen over and over again. Right now, throughout Italy, they're attempting this. In Rome, it's tragic. They're trying to decentralize all new employment and facilities because they think the center of Rome is too congested. Well, you know, the reality is a congested city is a healthy city. And the more congested it gets, the more vital, the more activity, and perhaps the more transit and walking people will do. That's great. Trying to solve that problem by breeding satellite cities basically just destroys, you know, eventually it can have the ultimate consequence of exactly what our suburban sprawl did to our inner cities for 50 years, which was decant all the vitality and economic energy. So that strategy could profoundly backfire.
Question.
So I don't buy it. I don't buy it either.
I think we can get in one more question. The initiative luncheon started at 12:45, folks. Yes, ma'am.
Well, you know, we actually did that plan you're talking about. And I think actually that plan is exactly the how-to avoid the, I think, the NIMBYism that seems to rise when you talk about infill and redevelopment. Because it settled for the city, many neighborhoods, it said, look, when we talk about infill, and let's say the regional plan says that you need 45 or 50% of the future growth is going to happen as infill in the central city. Let's say that's one of the outcomes of a hypothetical region. Now, that could be very frightening to the city citizens, but for a plan like the one you're talking about, which actually says, yes, and we're going to handle that 50% of increment along these corridors, in these underutilized places, in these places that you've designated as areas of change, and we are not going to touch the neighborhoods that you've designated as areas of preservation. So that is actually the mechanism by which you allow the central city to absorb a much greater percentage of the regional growth than it had been doing in the past. And so, you know, I think it's a good example. There's a lot of implementation mechanisms that have to come into being. And there's no question that any of this, whether it's a good county plan, district plan, quarter plan, neighborhood plan, there's going to be NIMBY opposition. There's going to be people who say, we like it just the way it is. We're scared of change. We don't want that. That's always going to happen. But clearly, making that delineation as part of a city general plan, the areas of change, the areas of no change, is one giant step towards coping with NIMBYism. And I know we've all debated endlessly because we, as practitioners, NIMBYism is one of the biggest things. Having that as a required component of a comprehensive or general plan, I think would go, if it was across the country, if it was normative, would really solve a lot of our NIMBY problems.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you join me in thanking this panel?
I should also say that he was